we're seeing Parkinson's become now actually the fastest growing neurological disease worldwide is because our world has become much more industrialized.
CPR. This conversation picks up right where we left off in part one.
Every single individual is like a different chain of dominoes falling down.
Mm.
Does that sound so? That's difficult. So how would I notice in myself if I was developing Parkinson's? What would I see?
The early symptoms that can be enough to seek attention of a neurologist would be if you notice change in sense of smell. So if you're having difficulties smelling things in the same way, or even taste, because smell and taste are linked. So if foods don't taste the same way, you can't smell odors in the same way. If there's a change in your bowel habits, so that if you were someone who had a bowel movement daily and now you're going 2 to 3 days without having a bowel movement, that could be a change. And then, as I mentioned, the one with the greatest predictor of concern is REM behavioral disorder. So if you notice a change in your sleep such that you're yelling, talking, thrashing, falling out of bed, that's a problem. Even early on.
That one's not subtle.
No, that one's not subtle. When I was a neurology resident, one time I was called down to the ER because a person had come to the ER with injury, having fallen out of bed. The patient was saying, well, why did they call neurology? Like, I fell out of bed. Like, oh, this is, have anything to do with neurologists? And I said, well, we know babies can fall out of bed, or infants, but adults don't fall out of bed. We know that signals some neurological problem. If you're totally asleep and dreaming and then you find yourself on the floor, then that's a neurological problem. That's not just, you don't just need to be cared for whatever injury you had at the time. You need to start seeing a neurologist because that denotes that there's a problem in the nervous system that caused this to occur.
I don't think I've ever called down neurology to the emergency department for someone falling out.
Oh, no?
You're going to get a lot of angry colleagues. Like, oh. 3 a.m. I don't need to be called. I should start. Or at least referring them. Yeah. But what could I see in terms of a loved one or a friend, family member from the outside that either they may or may not appreciate that would let me know, hey, I should suggest that you go see a neurologist, yeah, or at least your doctor.
So some things could be subtle. So we talked about change in their facial expression, change in their walking pattern. If they start to develop some stoop in their posture, if their stance and stride changes so that they're not taking as big steps and their gait is more narrow. If they have a change in voice, so Parkinson's also affects the voice such that a person doesn't project as much. So there's a change in voice volume. There's a change in voice prosodies. They're not as fluent, for example. So having a softer voice is pretty common with Parkinson's. And then even other things like change in handwriting. There's something called micrographia. So if you receive, not that people write much anymore, but if you receive a note from your loved one and the handwriting looks smaller and maybe even more difficult to read, that could be another sign of early Parkinson's. And these are all things that could be subtle and very gradual onset. And may not be easily attributed to potentially the start of Parkinson's. The more common sign, as you mentioned earlier, is tremor. Once a person develops tremor, we know tremor is never a normal part of aging. So that's usually an easy marker that something is wrong. But these other things are certainly more subtle, and patients often delay getting to a neurologist because, again, they're attributing it to something else.
Yeah. And so who is going to get Parkinson's? Who's at risk?
Yeah, Parkinson's is a problem of aging still. So the most common diagnosed person is someone who's 60 or older. We've started seeing patients much earlier than that, patients in their 50s, 40s, even as early as in their 20s. The earliest patient I diagnosed was 24 years old, and I still follow him. And really, this is a man with no other risk factors. And by risk factors, I mean no other family member with Parkinson's, no environmental exposure. He was a student at the time. No other thing that could be thought of that would cause Parkinson's. So certainly an issue of aging. It's an issue of being a man. Males are more commonly affected than women.
By a lot?
It's at least 1.5 to as high as 2 times more common in men. Okay. there are certain ethnic groups that are more commonly affected. So Hispanics more commonly affected than Caucasians, and also than Asians and African Americans, which are for reasons we don't well understand, but we have seen that globally that Hispanics are more commonly affected. And then when it comes to other risk factors or certain occupational exposures that increase risk, so there are certain environmental chemicals that can increase risk, other hazards. We don't see this very often anymore, but welders using manganese, or in the past, certain occupations using mercury. We still see a higher incidence of Parkinson's in dentists, for example, as an occupational hazard. Even one of the patients I saw this morning was a dentist, actually, who just had recently retired.
Why? Do they use mercury?
Not to the degree that was used in the past, but
so. Is that what's in my fillings? Like, where are they using mercury?
Yeah.
So I was not aware of this. All right. So certain professions like dentistry, anyone else that's at particular risk besides men, older men?
Yeah. And then those who are of certain other ethnic groups. So Ashkenazi Jews, for example, I mentioned globally, it's about 12.7%, but in Ashkenazi Jewish population, the percentage of Parkinson's is higher, due to a specific gene mutation called the LRRK2 mutation that can increase the percentage of patients of Ashkenazi Jewish heritage to have that gene mutation go on to develop Parkinson's more so in like the 30% range. And so just 12%, 12.7, we're looking more like in the 30% range. So ethnic groups that are also at higher risk.
Are there any other professions that besides dentistry that are at particular risk? I'm imagining people that might work around pesticides or other kinds of chemicals.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. So we certainly see Parkinson's higher in those who have worked with pesticides. And there's those who work with other like industrial solvents and industries. Parkinson's, even in the U.S., is seen, for example, with higher rates in the Rust Belt of the U.S., that Midwestern belt.
That's me. That's where I am.
Oh, okay.
Go on.
Yeah. There's trichloroethylene CE, which is a odorless chemical that's used in as an industrial solvent to clean metal parts, for example. It's used in other cleaning processes. It was even used in dry cleaning business up until the 70s. It was even used to decaffeinate coffee. And it's no longer that anymore, but it's chemical that's still being pretty ubiquitously used in certain industries, fertilizers. And because of that, what happens is it seeps into the ground, and because it's odorless and colorless, it can evaporate and then enter into people's homes and schools and businesses, and then be present and around for people to then inhale, essentially, and then be associated with Parkinson's. So we see clusters of people with Parkinson's in areas where fertilizers were used with greater frequencies. Even in my own practice, I have multiple couples who both have Parkinson's. And it's like, well, obviously they're not related. They're married, but we're not looking at consanguinity here. They're
probably not cousins.
Yeah. But they're living in the same household. They may have lived in the same house for a long time. And we also see clusters. So in certain communities, there will be a few patients of mine with Parkinson's on the same street. So they'll get to know each other. They're like, oh, we all go to this doctor. And it's like, why in this particular area, in this particular town, is there this cluster of Parkinson's also? And this has been shown in other communities. There's a book, Ending Parkinson's Disease, put out by Ray Dorsey, who's a neurologist at University of Rochester, who's really put forth the concept of environmental exposures being definitively linked with higher instances of Parkinson's disease.
So, and then not everyone gets it, because now we're talking again with that epigenetics, the genes have to be present to create the vulnerability, and then the environment has to be present.
Right.
As the old saying goes, genes load the gun and environment triggers it.
Correct. Yeah.
What about eating and drinking said toxins? Obviously, if it's in the groundwater, that's very bad.
Yes.
What about things like going to the supermarket and buying some produce?
It's certainly important to understand other potential sources for toxins, and how much of this can we control. It is also worrisome, because recent reports of even microplastics being associated with Parkinson's disease. So microplastics are plastic fragments smaller than, I believe, 5 millimeter in size, component of which can actually enter into our circulation and even enter into the brain. What has been shown from these microplastic studies is that microplastics then interact with normal alpha-synuclein and can cause it to phosphorylate. So they've proven this in not only a petri dish, for example, but also even in mice, where they inject microplastic into mice who then go on to manifest clinical symptoms of Parkinson's disease. So there's certainly a link, at least in an animal model, of microplastics being associated with Parkinson's disease. And microplastics are common. They're present in plastic cups, cutlery, the plastics that are used to package things. So it's a big problem. And that's why also we're seeing Parkinson's become now actually the fastest growing neurological disease worldwide, is because our world has become much more industrialized. We're producing our foods that have been used with fertilizers and then package them in plastics and other items that could also be causing changes that then lead to Parkinson's.
Wow. So not only is it people knowingly using the chemicals that have risks, like machinists and welders and farmers and the communities that are around these people, but it's anyone that eats. That has to be a little... And then maybe even eat seafood, because that's fish. There's the mercury there. Right. Then they get packaged in plastic. That is, wow. All right. Is there a threshold in terms of how much microplastics?
It's still being studied. So it's not clear what that threshold is, but how much exposure a person has to have over time, that's not clear.
What about being at risk for other things, like just not exercising enough? Because you had previously mentioned that exercise is fantastic for helping. What about for the vast majority of people who aren't moving at all?
Yeah. I mean, that's certainly another big risk factor, because our society has never been as sedentary as it is now. And we know that when it comes to brain function, it's similar to our extremity muscles. It's use it or lose it. So the more a person exercises and does that as part of a daily practice or routine, then that's the best way to keep your dopamine cells healthy. I mentioned earlier that right now exercise is the only intervention that has been associated with disease modification, whereby people who exercise have slower rates of progression of their Parkinson's, and no medication, no other intervention has been shown, that to be the case. So for at-risk individuals, we emphasize exercising and having that as part of a daily practice of incorporating different forms of exercise, whether it's aerobic, strength training, balance, flexibility. There's a variety of different exercise modalities. And the variety is actually even better than doing a single modality alone too, because then you're always challenging your brain and body in different ways. So I emphasize regular exercise, incorporating a variety of different types of exercise, and ultimately patients doing what they love to do. So I don't prescribe a specific type of exercise, but rather just emphasize the importance of doing exercise and really setting aside time for exercise. So it's not enough to say, well, I'm going to be physically active. And for me, being physically active is different than exercising, because people say, well, I'm doing laundry and washing dishes, I'm active. Well, there, your focus is on completing the task at hand. Your focus is not on how am I breathing? How am I moving? What muscles am I activating? When you're exercising, you're in tune to your body versus in tune to the task. So exercise over just being physically active and being mindful of differentiating between the two. The other core tenets or the foundations of care would be proper diet and sleep. And so we talk about those three pillars of exercise, sleep, and diet as being key to keeping those dopamine cells as healthy as possible.
I have to ask, what is proper diet, proper sleep?
Yes. With sleep, we look at sleep quality and quantity. So for adults, it's important to emphasize that when it comes to sleep quality, it's trying to get sleep at the time when we're supposed to be sleeping. So following what's called the circadian rhythm, natural rhythm of sleep, not sleeping during the day, avoiding daytime napping, and rather consolidating all your sleep at night. If a person has some other primary sleep disorder, treating that, because sleep disorders are very treatable. If a person has obstructive sleep apnea, if they have limb movement disorder, restless leg syndrome, whatever the case may be, treating the sleep disorder as best as possible to give a person as good quality of sleep as possible. And then the quantity, looking at this 7 to 9 hours or 7 to 8 hours for adults, and making sure that's, again, a good consolidated sleep. So I'll ask patients, when you wake up in the morning, do you feel refreshed? If the answer is no, after sleeping the appropriate period of time, then we need to determine why is that the case. If we suspect a sleep disorder breathing, then we'll do a sleep study. Or if we suspect around behavioral disorder, sleep study would be helpful. For other things, a sleep study is not necessary. Like if a person has restless leg syndrome, because that's also seen more commonly in people with Parkinson's, then that's based on history. We don't need to do a sleep study to diagnose and manage that piece. But managing sleep disorders is very important because the dopamine cells are also active throughout the day and night, and they're making dopamine and storing it. So if a person is getting poor quality sleep, they're not having as good dopamine stores for the next day's utilization, if you will. So you want to build your dopamine stores to have better motor control the next day. So poor sleep leads to worsened motor symptoms the following day for those with Parkinson's.
One of the things I know will lead to poor sleep is stress, psychosocial stress,
yes,
loneliness, all that. Does that have any impact on who gets Parkinson's? Are the people that experience great deals of distress at more risk outside of sleep?
Yes. Yeah. So there have been some interesting studies looking at acute stressors being linked to Parkinson's. So they're looking at both chronic stressors and acute stressors. So the example of acute stressors would be loss of a child, for example. So I have several people.
You just picked the worst, most stressful thing that you could possibly pick.
Yeah. Yeah. So a child becomes a victim of a crime and is killed or is suddenly killed in a car accident or due to illness like cancer. The death of a child is such a big stressor that I have several patients in my practice where soon after that occurs, they develop Parkinson's. And then, of course, the chronic stressors, looking at poor monetary resources, poor housing, poor social networks, that goes back to the isolation. All those stressors over time, that psychological stressor leads to physiological stressors within the brain cells. And again, the dopamine cells are very vulnerable to those physiological stressors, and those people are more likely to go on to develop Parkinson's. Now,
are you able to say more about how?
Yeah, the precise mechanism, I'm not sure that's well looked at.
There's a lot of stuff we don't know yet.
We know that stress has an effect on that oxidative stress property within the brain. So even in undergrad, one of my professor mentors, her research was looking at stress in the very young and how that affects dopamine levels. She would study rat pups. She would take a new rat litter and remove the mother from the litter. She would then isolate the individual rat pups from the litter and then study their dopamine levels using a catheter that was inserted into the brain and at measuring the dopamine levels for those stressed rat pups and looking at how that stress very early on can then result in dopamine changes early and how that can then manifest later on with continued dysfunction of the dopamine system. So stress across the spectrum of a person's lifetime can certainly be associated with increased probability of developing a neurodegenerative condition.
I've heard, you're talking about animal models of Parkinson's, heard from some scientists that we know how to cure Parkinson's in animals. Do you know anything about that? It just doesn't seem to translate to humans.
That's right. Yeah. So that's been what extraordinarily frustrating in our community is we have good models for Parkinson's in animals and interventions such as molecules that, for example, help to reduce alpha-synuclein within them or other modalities to help introduce new dopamine cells to an area and have them flourish and continue to make dopamine cells. But when those preclinical interventions are applied to humans, we're just not seeing that same rate of improvement. And so what we see in the animal models just doesn't translate. So whether the animal models are imperfect, that could be the case. We just haven't seen those improvements translate into humans just yet.
That's frustrating for everybody. What about, that's a couple more things about it. Who's at risk? What about people that smoke or do other kinds of drugs?
Yeah. So interestingly, those are in opposite directions. So people who smoke have been shown to have reduced rates of Parkinson's.
Oh my gosh. And I can't let this news get out.
And so even the...
Cover your ears, everyone.
Right. Even when looking at the epidemiology globally of Parkinson's, they say, well, the rates of Parkinson's are increasing for three reasons. People are living longer. The world's becoming more industrialized and so our food sources are changing. And the rates of smoking globally are dropping.
This implies that the stuff we're breathing in that causes Parkinson's is more toxic than the huge number of chemicals in each cigarette.
Yeah. Right. Whether it doesn't seem like it's just nicotine alone. It's something about that, which has never been well characterized either. They've done studies on just pure nicotine. Does nicotine help Parkinson's? And not really. Certainly, we're not telling anyone to begin smoking, of course, but that's what's seen epidemiologically. From the perspective of drug use, the most famous example of this is a drug called MPTP, which was, it's a synthetic version of heroin. And back in the 80s, there was a cluster of patients who developed acute onset Parkinson's. Then there was a documentary done about this called The Case of the Frozen Addicts. Someone was trying to make heroin and made this synthetic form of it, which was immediately neurotoxic. So MPTP causes dysfunction of the dopamine cells and kills them off fairly quickly. So these people went from, in some cases, just overnight to develop motor symptoms of Parkinson's. So we know that drugs can certainly be toxic to the brain, certain drugs.
Wow. What about the ones that we're commonly used to, like marijuana and alcohol?
Those have not been shown to be associated. There are some thought looking at even the medicinal types of cannabinoids and looking at some ways to use them in patients with Parkinson's to help improve stiffness, to help improve sleep. So the jury's still out about the utility of using CBD and THC with regards to Parkinson's symptoms. But then there's also prescription medications that cause a Parkinson-like condition, so drug-induced Parkinsonisms. There are medications that we use in clinical practice that are very helpful, but can be associated with the motor symptoms of Parkinson's. So things that are dopamine receptor blocking agents. So drugs that block dopamine from exerting effect can then cause a Parkinsonism because you're blocking that neurochemical. And these are things like antipsychotics, antiemetics, so medications that prevent nausea, vomiting, like Reglan or Compazine. These medications, since they block dopamine, can cause a Parkinsonism. And so we see drug-induced Parkinson cases pretty commonly in our practice, and we work with their referring clinicians to find alternatives because drug-induced Parkinsonism is fully reversible once the person stops taking that medication. But it also is important in any patient who has Parkinson's disease already not to be exposed to this category of medications. For example, if a person with Parkinson's develops a urinary tract infection, ends up in the ER, confused and delirious and hallucinating, being mindful not to use medications that block dopamine like Haldol, which is a commonly used antipsychotic because it works fairly quickly.
Yeah. Now I've seen too many patients come in from nursing homes with a history of Parkinson's and then on their list is Haldol or something very similar to it.
Right.
And I go, we got to stop this before you get back there. So in our final little bit that we have time, tell me more about how a person that has symptoms is going to figure out for sure that they have it by seeing the neurologist. What is the neurologist going to do? And then what can we do for that person?
Yes. So if a person presents even with these mild symptoms at the very start of what they are concerned about, maybe Parkinson's, and if after the interview and examination, we concur that, yeah, perhaps this may be very early Parkinson's, then there are two ways to provide objective evidence of Parkinson's. So one is a skin biopsy test, as I mentioned, called the SYN1 biopsy to look for synuclein changes. So that would be seen in patients who have a synucleinopathy, which is those with Parkinson's disease, but also those with other Parkinson-like conditions, one called Lewy body dementia and the other one called multiple system atrophy. And in the skin biopsy, if there are phosphoalpha-synuclein fibers seen, then that's pretty concrete. And Michael J. Fox Foundation announced less than a year ago that phosphorylated alpha-synuclein is a definitive biomarker for Parkinson's. So there's nothing else in clinical medicine that would lead to this result. It has a very high specificity for Parkinson's. So that is one modality. The other modality is doing what's called a DAT scan, a dopamine transporter scan. So whereby ioflupane is injected, and this is a radioactive tracer that binds to dopamine receptors in the striatum. So if we're concerned that a person has a deficiency in the nigrostriatal pathway, then a DAT scan would be equally helpful. And certainly there are cases where we would choose one modality versus the other. A DAT scan and skin biopsy, they have their roles in clinical practice for sure. And now with either modality, we're able to really give patients a definitive answer pretty early so that we're not just basing our diagnosis on clinical grounds, but rather on objective evidence. And combining our clinical acumen with one of these objective tests is really now the gold standard way to diagnose, because we know from studies actually that if we try to just clinically diagnose a person early on, we might be wrong a quarter of the time, like 25% of the time, we might think a person has Parkinson's and they don't. Wow. We follow them over time. And then we see, actually, this person may have some other reason why they're slow, stiff and slow, for example. So doing a definitive study early on, I think, is valuable. Then from there, once we definitively diagnose a person with Parkinson's, there are a variety of medication options.
Speaking of medications, I have to ask the question. If a person was diagnosed purely clinically,
yes,
but they respond to the medicine, do they definitely have Parkinson's, or might they still have a mimic?
They might still have a mimic. So gone are the days when we're doing levodopa trials. So levodopa is the main medication that gets converted directly to dopamine by an enzyme in the brain, and thus you boost your dopamine levels that way. But there are still the Parkinson mimics that where there's some response to dopamine, and that's not enough to feel comfortable with the diagnosis. Because we certainly, as movement disorder neurologists, we've seen patients who are on levodopa for a long period of time, say 5 years, and yet they're totally stable. They're not fluctuating. They're not seeing any, we're not making any change to their regimen. And that's unusual because Parkinson's is progressive. So if you're not having any change to your dopamine levels, you're not having fluctuations of symptoms after 5 years, and then that's a red flag that you've had some response, but you actually don't have Parkinson's.
Wow. Yeah.
So we're not doing the levodopa trials anymore.
Things have certainly changed. Okay. So what else can we do for people? It sounds like carbidopa, levodopa, our medication that goes in the brain and acts like dopamine. Mm-hmm. What else is there?
Yeah. So there's dopamine agonists. So these are medications that bind to dopamine receptors, and to activate them in a way that, like a synthetic form of dopamine instead of the actual dopamine, there are what are called MAOB inhibitors. So medications that block an enzyme that causes dopamine to break down and thus allowing dopamine to exert its effect longer. There are anticholinergics. These are medications that work to block acetylcholine. So acetylcholine and dopamine, it's like a seesaw. Too much acetylcholine is associated with too little dopamine and vice versa. So blocking acetylcholine can help raise dopamine levels indirectly. There are
Are you talking about things as simple as Benadryl or way more potent?
Oh, sorry. Things more like Artane, Cogentin, even Amantadine has a bit of allergic property to it. So there's that category. Then there are some agents that also indirectly help with dopamine function, like medications that work on blocking glutamate, like Amantadine does that also. Aside from medications, there are also surgical options to treat Parkinson's as well. One option, and here's where the subtypes make a difference too. So one option is deep brain stimulation, which is the most effective way of treating Parkinson's tremor. So even patients who don't respond well to levodopa to help reduce their tremor, deep brain stimulation can be very effective in that regard. So for those who have had Parkinson's for 4 years or more and are tremor predominant, then we often go the route of using deep brain stimulation to control motor symptoms, because that way we can keep their medication burden lower by treating their symptoms electrically instead of chemically with medication. For those who are in the other categories, like an akinetic rigid category, if they're on oral medications and they're not seeing sufficient response or developing side effects like dyskinesias, which are involuntary dance-like motions due to fluctuations of dopamine levels, then we can try to minimize those fluctuations by using infusion treatment. So there's something called DUOPA, which is an infusion of levodopa. So a levodopa gets infused directly through a tube that goes into the stomach and then into the small intestine, where the levodopa is absorbed directly. So it bypasses the stomach and the issues associated with absorption by delivering the medication directly to the jejunum in the small intestine and absorbed that way. And DUOPA can keep the levels pretty steady of dopamine, so patients have less fluctuations. And then another even newer modality is focused ultrasound. So using high frequency ultrasound beams to target cells within the striatum to reduce tremors in Parkinson's. So there's a variety of different modalities that can be used.
Well, that's good because Parkinson's seems to go, as you mentioned, just one direction, but it's nice to hear that we have more than just one medication. We have a number of medications and there are a number of non-medication based therapies as well, including physical therapy and exercise, which you mentioned before.
Yeah.
This has been fantastic. I feel like I could talk to you for so many more hours because you're a wealth of knowledge, but I know you have patients to see. So with your parting words, what message would you want to send out to people who have Parkinson's or have loved ones with Parkinson's?
So it's important to develop your team, your Parkinson's team. Certainly the work I do is not in isolation, but seeing a movement disorder specialist and then making sure that you're not just seeing that specialist, but also working with a team. So we talked about physical therapists. So we also have occupational therapists, speech therapists at our site. We have a full-time social worker. We have two full-time on-site here, and then other specialists who will be part of your team over time, but making sure that those are incorporated also. So if you need to see a gastroenterologist or cardiologist or dermatologist for other issues, that those resources are also available to you. But having that core team of your movement disorder specialists and the therapist and social worker and neuropsychologist is really important because they're going to be your guides to getting all of these symptoms that we discussed, the complexity of Parkinson's, getting that as best managed as possible.
The team approach, always best. Yeah. Dr. Machado, thank you so very much.
Yeah, thank you for this opportunity to chat. It's been a pleasure.
So what did we talk about today? Let's recap. Five things. One, Parkinson's disease is growing more rampant by the year. Two, symptoms usually start years before they're realized to be symptoms of PD. Three, these early symptoms can include loss of smell or taste, new constipation, and sleep disorders. Four, there are numerous risk factors besides genetics, including toxins and stress. Five, there are numerous treatments to slow and manage the symptoms, but no cure yet. If you'd like to contribute to the research going on today, you should. You can contribute with money or by participating in a research study. When I say research study, you might be imagining pills or wires in your brain, but there's a survey study that literally any adult with internet access can participate in called the Parkinson's Progression Markers Initiative that's just trying to gather as much data as possible to figure out more about the current and future health of people that get Parkinson's disease. This is one of the studies that helped validate the alpha-synuclein test that Dr. Machado talks about. You can find it at michaeljfox.org/PPMI. There are also centers enrolling for an exercise study at sparks3pd.com. That's SPARKX, the number 3, PD.com. And as long as you're online, please leave a 5-star review for this podcast. As always, remember, the way you live can save your life.